Chapter 19. On the 24th September 1833, the Reverend Mr. Casseaux, Secretary of the Bishop of Quebec, presented to me the official letters which named me the vicar of the Reverend Mr. Peraz, Archpriest and Curate of St. Charles. I was soon on my way with a cheerful heart to fill the post assigned to me by my superior. The parish of St. Charles is beautifully situated about 20 miles southwest of Quebec, on the banks of a river. Its large farmhouses and barns, neatly whitewashed with lime, were the symbols of peace and comfort. I had often heard of the Reverend Mr. Peraz as one of the most learned, pious, and venerable priests of Canada. When I arrived, he was absent on a sick call, but his sister received me with every mark of refined politeness. Under the burden of her 55 years, she had kept all the freshness and amiability of youth. After a few words of welcome, she showed me my study and sleeping room. The two rooms were the perfection of neatness and comfort. I shut the doors and fell on my knees to thank God and the Blessed Virgin for having given me such a home. 10 minutes later, I came back to the large parlor, where I found Miss Peraz waiting to offer me a glass of wine. She then told me how her brother, the curate, and herself were happy when they heard that I was to come and live with them. She had known my mother before her marriage, and she told me how she had passed several happy days in her company. She could not speak to me of any subject more interesting than my mother, for though she had died a few years before, she had never ceased to be present in my mind and near and dear to my heart. Soon, curate arrived and I rose to meet him, but it is impossible to adequately express what I felt at that moment. Reverend Mr. Peraz was then about 65 years old. He was a tall man, almost a giant. No king ever bore his head with more dignity, but his beautiful blue eyes were the embodiment of kindness. There was on his face an expression of peace, calm piety, and kindness which entirely won my heart and my respect. When, with a smile on his lips, he extended his hands toward me, I fell on my knees and said, "Mr. Peraz, God sends me to you that you may be my teacher and my father. You will have to guide my first and inexperienced steps in the holy ministry. Do bless me, and pray that I may be a good priest as you are yourself." That unpremeditated and earnest act of mine so touched the good old priest that he could hardly speak. Leaning towards me, he raised me up and pressed me to his bosom. With a voice trembling with emotion, he said, "May God bless you, my dear sir, and may he also be blessed for having chosen you to help me to carry the burden of the ministry in my old age." After half an hour of the most interesting conversation, he showed me his library, which was very large and composed of the best books which a priest of Rome is allowed to read, and he very kindly put it at my service. During the 8 months which it was my privilege to remain with the venerable Mr. Peraz, the conversation was exceedingly interesting, and I never heard from him any idle, frivolous talking, as is so much the habit among the priests. He was well versed in the literature, philosophy, history, and theology of Rome. He had personally known almost all the bishops and priests of the last 50 years. His memory was well stored with anecdotes and facts concerning the clergy from almost the days of the Congress of Canada. I could write many interesting things were I to publish what I heard from him concerning the doings of the clergy. I will only give two or three of the facts of that interesting period of the church in Canada. A couple of months before my arrival at St. Charles, the vicar who preceded me, called Lujas, had publicly eloped with one of his beautiful penitents. After 3 months of public scandal, she had repented and come back to her heartbroken parents. About the same time, a neighboring curate, in whom I had great confidence, compromised himself also with one of his fair parishioners in a most shameful, though less public, way. These two scandals distressed me exceedingly, and for nearly a week I felt so overwhelmed with shame that I dreaded to show my face in public, and I almost regretted that I ever became a priest. My nights were sleepless. I could hardly eat anything. My conversations with Mr. Perez had lost their charms. "Are you sick, my young friend?" said he to me one day. "No, sir, I am not sick, but I am sad." He replied, "Can I know the cause of your sadness? You used to be cheerful and happy since you came here. Please tell me what is the matter with you. I am an old man, and I know many remedies for the soul as well as the body." "The two last awful scandals by the priests," I answered, "are the cause of my sadness. The news has fallen upon me like a thunderbolt. Though I had heard something of that nature when I was a simple ecclesiastic in the college, the human frailty of so many is really distressing. How can one hope to stand up on one's own feet when one sees such strong men fall by one's side? What will become of our Holy Church in Canada and all over the world if her most devoted priests are so weak and have so little self-respect and so little fear of God?" "My dear young friend," answered Mr. Perez, "our Holy Church is infallible. The gates of hell cannot prevail against her. But the assurance of her perpetuity and infallibility does not rest on any human foundation. It does not rest on the personal holiness of her priest, but it rests on the promises of Jesus Christ." "Her perpetuity and infallibility are a perpetual miracle. It requires the constant working of Jesus Christ to keep her pure and holy, in spite of the sins and scandals of her priests. Even the clearest proof that our Holy Church has a promise of perpetuity and infallibility is drawn from the very sins and scandals of her priests, for whose sins and scandals would have destroyed her long ago if Christ was not in the midst to save and sustain her. Just as the Ark of Noah was miraculously saved by the mighty hand of God when the waters of the deluge would otherwise have wrecked it, so our Holy Church is miraculously prevented from perishing in the flood of iniquities by which too many priests have deluged the world. Let therefore your faith and confidence in our Holy Church and your respect for her remain firm and unshaken in the midst of all these scandals. Just as the valiant soldier makes superhuman efforts to save the flag when he sees those who carried it fall on the battlefield. Oh, you will see more of our flag bearers slaughtered before you reach my age. I am near the end of my course, and thanks be to God, my faith in our Holy Church is stronger than ever. Though I have seen and heard many things compared with this, which the facts which just now distress you are mere trifles. In order to the better to prepare you for the conflict, I think it is my duty to tell you a fact which I got from the late Lord Bishop Plessis. I have never revealed it to anybody, but my interest in you is so great that I will tell it to you, and my confidence in your wisdom is so absolute that I am sure you will never abuse it. We must never let it be known to the people, for it would diminish, if not destroy, their respect and confidence in us. without which it would become almost impossible to lead them. I have already told you that the late Venerable Bishop Pleasus was my personal friend. Every summer, when he had reached the end of his 3 months of episcopal visitation of his diocese, he used to come and spend 8 or 10 days of absolute rest and enjoyment of private and solitary life with me in this parsonage. The 2 rooms you occupy were his, and he told me many times that the happiest days of his episcopal life were those passed in this solitude. One summer he came, more worn out than ever, and I was almost frightened by the air of distress which covered his face. I supposed that this was due to his extreme fatigue, and I hoped that the next morning he would again be more amiable and interesting of men. I was also completely worn out and slept soundly till 3 o'clock in the morning. I was then suddenly awakened by sobs and half-suppressed lamentations and prayers which were coming from the bishop's room. Without losing a moment, I went and knocked at the door, inquiring about the cause of these sobs. Evidently, the poor bishop had not suspected that I could hear him. "Sobs? Sobs?" he answered. "What do you mean by that? Please go back to your room and sleep. Do not trouble yourself about me. I am well," and he absolutely refused to open the door of his room. The remaining hours of the night, of course, were sleepless ones for me. The sobs of the bishop were more suppressed, but he could not prevent me from hearing them. The next morning his eyes were red and his face showed that he had suffered intensely. After breakfast I said to him, "My lord, last night has been one of the desolation to your lordship. For God's sake and in the name of the sacred ties of friendship, please tell me the cause of your sorrow. It will become less the very moment you share it with your friend." The bishop answered me, "You are right when you think that I am under the burden of a great desolation, but its cause is of such a nature that I cannot reveal it even to you, my dear friend." In vain, the rest of the day, I did all that I could to persuade Monsignor Pleasus to reveal the cause of his grief. His lordship, that evening, withdrew to his sleeping room sooner than usual, but sleep was out of the question for me that night, for his desolation seemed to be so great, I feared finding my dear friend dead in his bed the next morning. I watched him from the adjoining room from 10 o'clock till the next morning. I could see that his sorrow was still more intense that night. I formed an extreme resolution, which I put into effect the very moment that he came out of his room the next morning. "My lord," said I thought till the night before last that you honored me with your friendship, but I see today that I was mistaken. You do not consider me as your friend, for if I were a friend worthy of your confidence, you would unburden your heart into mine. What is the use of friendship if it be not to help each other to carry the burdens of life? I found myself honored by your presence in my house, so long as I considered myself as your own friend. Besides, it seems to me very probable that the terrible burden which you want to carry alone will kill you, and that very soon. I do not at all like the idea of finding you suddenly dead in my parsonage, and having the coroner make painful inquiries. Then, my lord, be not offended if I respectfully request your lordship to find another lodging as soon as possible." My words fell upon the bishop like a thunderbolt. With a deep sigh, he looked in my face, with his eyes rolling in tears, and said, "You are right, Peraz. I ought never to have concealed my sorrow from such a friend as you have always been, but you are the only one to whom I can reveal it. No doubt your priestly and Christian heart will not be less broken than mine, but you will help me with your prayers and wise counsels to carry it. However, before I initiate you into such an awful mystery, we must pray. We then knelt down and said together a chaplet to invoke the power of the Virgin Mary, after which we recited a psalm. Then the bishop said, "You know that I have just finished the visit of my immense diocese of Quebec. I will not speak to you of the people. They are in general truly religious and faithful to the church. But the priests, oh, great God, will I tell you what they are? My dear Peraz, I would almost die with joy if God would tell me that I am mistaken. But alas, I am not mistaken. The sad, the terrible truth is this. The priests, with the exception of you and three others, are infidels and atheists. Oh, my God, what will become of the church in the hands of such wicked men?" And covering his face with his hands, the bishop burst into tears, and for 1 hour could not say a word. I myself remained mute. At first I regretted having pressed the bishop to reveal such an unexpected mystery of iniquity, but after an hour of silence, almost unable to look each other in the face, I said, "My Lord, what you have told me is surely the saddest thing that I ever heard. But allow me to tell you that your sorrow is out of limits." I led him to the library and opened the pages of the history of the church and showed him the names of more than 50 popes who had been atheists and infidels. I read to him the lives of Borgia, Alexander VI, and a dozen others, who would surely and justly be hanged today by the executioner of Quebec, were they in that city, committing one half of the public crimes of adultery, murder, debauchery of every kind, which they committed in Rome, Avignon, Naples. I clearly proved to him that his priests, though infidels and atheists, were angels of piety, modesty, purity, and religion when compared with a Borgia, who publicly lived as a married man with his own daughter and had a child by her. He agreed with me that several of the Alexanders, the Johns, the Piuses, and the Leos were sunk much deeper in the abyss of iniquity than his priests. My conclusion was that if our Holy Church had been able to resist the deadly influence of such scandals during so many centuries in Europe, she would not be destroyed in Canada even by the legion of atheists by whom she is served today. The bishop acknowledged my conclusion. He thanked me for preventing him from despairing of the future of our Holy Church in Canada. The rest of the days which he spent with me, he was almost as cheerful and amiable as before. "Now, my dear young friend," added Mr. Peraz, "I hope you will be as reasonable and logical in your religion as Bishop Plessis, who is probably the greatest man Canada has ever had. When Satan tries to shake your faith by the scandals you see, remember that Pope, who, through revenge against his predecessor, had him exhumed, brought his dead body before the judges, then charged him with the most horrible crimes, which he proved by the testimony of scores of eyewitnesses, got the dead Pope condemned to be beheaded and dragged with ropes through the muddy streets of Rome and thrown into the river Tiber. Yes, when your mind is oppressed by the secret crimes of the priest, which you will know either through the confessional or by public rumor, Remember that more than 12 popes have been raised to that high and holy dignity by the rich and influential prostitutes of Rome, with whom they were publicly living in the most scandalous way. Remember young John the 11th, the son of Pope Sergius, who was consecrated pope when only 12 years old by the influence of his prostitute mother, Marosia, but who was so horribly profligate that he was deposed by the people and the clergy of Rome. Well, if our Holy Church has been able to pass through such storms without perishing, is it not a living proof that Christ is her pilot, that she is imperishable and infallible because St. Peter is her foundation? Oh my God, shall I confess what my thoughts were during that lecture of my curate, which lasted more than an hour? Yes, I must say the truth. When the priest was exhibiting to me the unmentionable crimes of so many of our popes, a mysterious voice was repeating to the ears of my soul the dear Savior's words, "A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth forth not good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them." In spite of myself, the voice of my conscience cried in thundering tones that a church whose head and members were so horribly corrupt could not by any means be the Church of Christ.